regard a person's status. Tell us then, what is your opinion? Is it lawful to pay the census tax to Caesar or not? Knowing their malice, Jesus said, Why are you testing me, you hypocrites? Show me the coin that pays the census tax. Then they handed him the Roman coin. He said to them, Whose image is this and whose inscription? They replied, Caesar's. At that he said to them, Then repay to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, and to God what belongs to God. The Gospel of the Lord.
And for whatever reason, the lectionary left out the very last sentence of this little thing. So I want to stick it in. It said, after he said, then repay to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, and to God what belongs to God. When they heard this, they were amazed, and leaving him, they went away. Mm. So the setting for this now, you know, is that there's mounting opposition against Jesus by the chief priests, the scribes, and so forth. They see him as a real threat, and they're trying to trap him. I mean, even as you were reading this, I mean, they sounded like such sleazy suck-ups, didn't mm-hmm. they? The way they were trying to buttering him up. Teacher, we know that you are a truthful man and that you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. So, yeah, give me a break. Shut up already. Who do you think you're kidding, you know? And Jesus is you know, there's mounting opposition against him because his basic message is that if you keep opposing me, it's not going to go well for you. And it will ultimately lead, and it's in Matthew's gospel, right? It will ultimately lead to the destruction of Jerusalem. Now that, of course, infuriated them. This is worse than like the destruction of a Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. is something meaningful to us and so forth. That maybe would be equivalent to the destruction of the Vatican, except that even more than that, because we as Catholics believe in the real presence of Christ in every Catholic church and every tabernacle. Imagine if the only place in the whole earth where the Eucharist resided, where Christ was truly present, was in the Vatican, no place else, you know. And you said, well, we're going to destroy that would get them very angry. And he's warning them they're going to face divine judgment. So they're trying to shut him up. And in Matthew's gospel, we hear a lot of parables of Jesus. This one, of course, is not a parable. This one is more of a riddle, you know, render to Caesar that which is Caesar, and to God which is to God. And I don't know why the lectionary leaves out that last sentence. I mean, it's just, you know, the Bible is structured, the new Catholic New American Bible, that begins with paying taxes to the emperor. And then it ends with that last sentence that I read. The next part is questions about the resurrection. So anyway, the people who went away, the people who it says were amazed, were very prominent Jewish leaders, the significant, important people of the Jewish people. And of course, they were trying to entrap him. And it says as much in here. The trap, of course, is very simple. Should you, is it lawful, is it, what was the words again? Tell us whether lawful. Where is it lawful to pay census tax to Caesar, or is it not? And they were looking for a simple yes or no answer. You could almost see them on one of these news, Fox News TV mm-hmm. shows. Answer the question, yes or no, you know. And either way, he's in trouble, right? If he says yes, it's okay to pay taxes to the Caesar. Well, again, remember, you know, you got to appreciate how the Jews in Palestine, never mind in Jerusalem itself, how they felt. How would we feel if there was an occupying army walking the, you know, the streets of the United States? Suppose Japanese won World War II. And so we were some sort of, I don't know, territory of Japan, and Japanese soldiers were, I mean, you wouldn't exactly look upon them welcoming in a welcoming way, in a kindly kind of way.
Well, also, Caesar was telling everyone he was a god.
With that's which, coming. That's which, part. Which of really, very much a part of this.
Really get
very, them. Very much a
Although
part of
the
this.
Japanese had their royal emperor.
That's right. Emperor. That's right. Their emperor. I don't know if they truly consider him to be god, but certainly godlike. You know, so a large sentiment among the Jews was that they hated the Romans. It was a foreign occupying army. And even among Jesus' disciples, James the Zealot, right? The Zealots were a I don't know if I would call them a party per se, but because a party is maybe too well organized. But there was a sect among those three kinds of Jews. There was the Sadducees, who were sucking up to the Romans. They were getting very rich by being friends with the Romans and saying, "Let the real, these are good people, just let them, they'll leave you alone if we leave them alone," sort of thing. Let's just coexist. They had probably, every Sadducees probably had a coexist bumper sticker on his car. Right? There were the Pharisees who the only different sect is that they believed in the resurrection of the dead, which means Jesus was a Pharisee, but you know. And then there were the Zealots, and the Zealots were the ones who wanted to, that's the Messiah for them was going to be another powerful king, civil kind of king, was going to raise up a mighty army and throw the occupying Romans out of Palestine. And so if Jesus said, and many Jews, whether they were zealots or not, the zealots were violent. I mean, they said whatever means necessary, including war, terror, whatever, just get them out. So if Jesus said, yes, it's okay to pay taxes to the emperor, he would have alienated himself from a huge number of his Jewish followers, because they would have said, okay, he's just a Roman sympathizer. Look at how the Jews looked at the Jewish tax collectors. They really regarded them as unclean Gentiles because they were colluding, and it's that word today, colluding. They were colluding with the Romans, and that just made them unclean. It made them, for all intents and purposes, to other Jews, it made them not Jews. It made them one among the Gentiles. So if Jesus said, yes, it's okay to pay tax to the Romans, they would have said, okay, he's a Roman sympathizer, he's no good either. If he said, no, you can't pay tax to the, then he, the Herodians, the Herodians were there too. It says not just the Pharisees, but the Herodians. Herod was king of Palestine. He was kind of Caesar's representative to that area to oversee the rule of Palestine. So he was a king, but he was a lesser king than the Caesar. So the Herodians were there too. In other words, the government was there along with the Pharisees to listen to his answer. If Jesus said, no, you can't pay taxes to these pagan Romans, then he would have been accused of sedition, and Roman soldiers would have been able to act then and shut him up. Okay, so either way, a real case, if he's, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. Okay, but it's not easy to trap Jesus. You know, they tried, but they failed to trap him. And his famous response is, show me the coin for the tax. It's a brilliant answer. And I think exactly what it says. He says, show me the coin that pays the census tax. The coin, of course, is the Roman denarius. Here's the Roman denarius. They've blown a picture for it, for what it looks like. And the picture on there, from around the year 14 to 37, the emperor, the Caesar, was Tiberius. And he produced a lot of these coins. I didn't have one when I was a kid. I was a coin collector when I was a kid. But I just got my coin collection by going through the pocket change of my father and my uncles and so forth, and picked out what I knew was worth holding on to. But there are a lot of these things. You could buy these things quite readily for not a lot of money, because he had so many of these coins struck, and that's a picture on there of the Emperor Tiberius. The interesting thing is, you know, what does Jesus say? He says, "Show me the coin." Whose image is this, and whose inscription? Okay, because you see, there's an inscription around that coin, and that inscription reads, Tiberius, Caesar, well, Divi Augusti Filius Augustus. The translation is Caesar Augustus Tiberius, son of the divine Augustus. Okay. So the previous two Caesars were not just Caesars, but they claimed to be divine. And so this guy, Tiberius, in the first place, is claiming to be the son of God, right? Because his father Augustus was divine. Secondly, there's a picture of Caesar on this thing, and you know Exodus chapter 20, verse 4, the Jews had a prohibition against graven images, and you know, well, there was cherubs on the Ark of the Covenant, so it wasn't just graven images, but it was graven images that kind of represented false gods. So this met that mm-hmm. requirement. It was a graven image of somebody who not only claimed to be God, but even put the inscription around this thing that said, you know, basically he is God. So there was a double whammy on this thing. About the graven image and about the claim to divinity. And again, when Jesus takes the coin, what does it say? What does Jesus say? Whose image is this and whose inscription? And they implied Caesar's. Okay. And he said to them, repay to Caesar what belongs to Caesar and to God what belongs to God. Post that, okay. So this is understood, of course, as Jesus lawfully giving permission to pay taxes, and Christianity has understood this from the beginning basically what Jesus is saying. And it's actually a brilliant answer: render to Caesar that which belongs to Caesar and to God which belongs to God. And again, if you got to keep in mind that this text comes to us from the Greek, right? The only scripture we have is in Greek, and of course the Greek word for image, when Jesus says image here, is icon. Okay, icon means image or likeness. And in if one were to read this in the context of the first century Greek and Jewish understanding in this very Greek environment, that same word icon is used back in the book of Genesis, where it says, if you look at the Greek translation of the Old Testament in Exodus, Genesis, it says that God made Adam and Eve, man and woman, as an icon of himself, in his image and likeness. So Jesus is setting up a contrast here. He's saying, whose icon, whose likeness is this on the coin? Okay? And they say Caesar. But to use that word icon, that word likeness, will automatically kind of pull your mind back to Genesis and God making man and woman in his own image and likeness. So there's a double meaning here. When he asks whom is on the coin, there's two ways you can think about this. And it is Genesis chapter 1, verse 26 and 27. So the man and the woman, in other words, human beings, bear the image and likeness of God. So Jesus says, you see the double image he's pulling up here. He's saying, whose image is this on the coin? Whose icon is this on the coin? And they're saying, well, it's Caesar's who claims to be God. But what else do you know about icons? Well, human beings are made in the image and likeness of God. So what Jesus is essentially saying, you give, in response to the Pharisees, he's saying, you can give your money to the emperor, but you give yourself to God.
So wouldn't that give the Pharisees and them more steam to say that he is God? If icon can mean God, wouldn't they even emphasize more to say, well, there it is?
Well, that was the claim, and that's the whole purpose of the first reading from Isaiah here, which is why
we didn't go over yet.
which why the lectionary ties in that first reading from Isaiah. And that's what they leave out, that last sentence in the lectionary, the last sentence that is part of this little passage, that they marvel. What were they actually marveling about? They were marveling about this juxtaposition of the two images that Jesus was putting up. They knew exactly what he meant. They knew that he was alluding to a Caesar who claimed to be God, but of course, to the Jews, wasn't. They found that very, very offensive, right? The Herodians, they probably didn't. I mean, but the Jews found that very offensive that he claimed to be God. But he's also saying, whose image and likeness? Image and likeness now automatically evokes human beings made in the image and likeness of God.
There's another thing that always gets me, because the Jews, I mean, from their base, is thou shalt have no graven images. So everything.
Well, we talked a little bit about that. Yeah, yeah.
It always comes back to that for them.
Yeah, you know, graven images is not, it doesn't mean you can't have a picture of, or you can't have a statue or something like that. It means more of false gods. You got to understand that in its right context.
But that's not what other people pull up and they...
Of course not. Because they interpret that wrongly. There's often a tendency to want to interpret that wrongly. Okay. And that's why we go, hello, that's why we go to in the lectionary, that's why we have that first reading from Isaiah. It's actually broken up a little bit. I think it starts with verse 1 and then it goes to verses 4, 5, and 6, right? You want to read that some, Bob? You got that handy? You want to read it?
That, as it was written, church, thus says the Lord to his anointed, Cyrus, whose right hand I grasp, subduing nations before him and making kings run in his service, opening doors before him and leaving the gates unbarred. For the sake of Jacob, my servant of Israel, my chosen one, I have called you by your name, giving you a title through you know me not. I am the Lord, and there is no other, there is no God besides me. It is I who arm you. Through you know me, a little bit bigger, so that towards the rising and the setting of the sun, people may know that there is none besides me. I am the Lord, there is no other.
Okay. So why did the church decide to pair this reading on paying taxes to the emperor with this brief passage from chapter 45 in Isaiah? Two important, as I say, it's in Isaiah, it's 1, and it goes through 4, 5, and 6. And it's really number 1 and number 6 that are the most significant here. Number 1, what's this allusion to? The Lord says to his anointed Cyrus, whose right hand I grasp, subduing nations before him, making kings run in his service. In the time of Isaiah, again, you have to recognize the unfolding of God, you know, God's revelation in the Old Testament. Okay? In the time of Isaiah, kings and whatnot, kings of Persia, the various places, were considered themselves to be gods. They made themselves deities. Okay, so this particular passage from Isaiah 45 is probably the single most powerful teaching by God speaking through Isaiah about monotheism. Okay? If you go back to early salvation history, what was the understanding of the Jews about God? Well, the Jews had their God, the God of Israel. The Persians had their God. The Canaanites had their God. There are lots of gods. There were gods all over the place, okay? And they said, okay, you've got your gods and we got our God and we're going to worship our God. Okay? But then as you look, there's an evolution that's happening in here. You start to see statements like, our God is greater than all these other gods. So they started to recognize that, wait a minute, you know, okay, there are all these gods in the world and we have our God, But look at what our God is doing for us. Our God seems to be greater than all these other gods. Their gods, we're defeating them in battle. Their gods are not helping them. Our God is helping us win. And then you evolve to the sort of things you see in Isaiah, where it says, I am the Lord, there is no other. There is no God besides me. It is I who arm you, though you know me not, so that toward the rising of the sun to the setting of the sun, men may know that there is none beside me. I am the Lord, there is no other. I form the light and create the darkness. I make the well-being and create you. I, the Lord, do these things. So it's evolved from not one God among many to one God being better than all these other gods to now these other gods aren't really other gods at all. There really is only one God, and that is the God of Israel. So you see why this is being paired with the gospel reading about a Caesar who makes a claim to divinity. Jesus is reminding the Jews there, you know better than this. You know that, yes, that the Caesar is going to make claims to divinity, but you know from Isaiah that there is no other God. There's only one God, and that's your God. Yeah.
Isn't the major difference that all the other people in religions had many gods, and the Jews had the one God?
Well, no. There were so many, so much. And so there's a double play on words going on here, too. The word that's used for God in here is Elohim. Elohim is one of those, I don't want to say unusual, but it's like one of those English words that could be singular or plural, sort of like bear. You could talk about a bear walking in the woods, and you could talk about bear walking in the woods.
Could you say that again? What's it called?
Elohim.
Oh, that's coming up a week from Tuesday.
What do you mean?
Elohim.
Elohim is the same word used for God, the true God, is Elohim. The word used for the false, we do it too. The only distinction we make is we put a capital, uppercase G for God, and if you look, it uses lowercase G's for the other gods. So again, there's a play on words going on here again, that these gods, which are like your God, are not gods at all. So that even Isaiah has this play on words. And the reason that's given is because these other gods didn't create anything. They didn't create that. They create the day and the night and the mountains and the heavens and so forth. No, only I created those things. So this from Isaiah is this is kind of the pinnacle, the culmination of the idea of Jewish monotheism, that there really aren't all these other gods running around. These other gods are not gods at all. As a matter of fact, Paul is going to use that. It's not in the reading for today, but Paul is going to use that. The psalm for today that I lose the page is 96. And I thought I had it marked, but maybe I didn't. You got, okay, why don't you read Psalm 96 for us then? I thought I had it here.
Got it?
No. Okay, go for it.
Well, give the Lord glory and honor. Sing to the Lord a new song. Sing to the Lord all you lands. Tell his glory among the nations, among all peoples, his wondrous deeds. For great is the Lord and highly to be praised. Awesome is he beyond all gods. For all the gods of the nations are things of naught, but the Lord made the heavens. Give to the Lord your families of nations. Give to the Lord glory and praise. Give to the Lord the glory due his name. Bring gifts and enter his courts. Worship the Lord in holy attire. Tremble before him. All the earth say among the nations, the Lord is King. He governs the people with equity.
Okay, two things there. One, of course, is the obvious that, you know, God is God and tremble before him and worship him and him alone. But it made an allusion to other gods, and it said, "All the other gods are what did they say? Mount to naught." Okay, as I think is the word they used in this translation. If you look at the Greek translation of the Psalms, which is the translation that St. Paul would have been familiar with, it doesn't say they amount to naught as far as gods go. It says they are daimones. It says they are demons. And that's when you look at Paul's teaching, he talks about the pagan religions worshiping, offering sacrifices to demons. And that was very much the Jewish theology of the day in the time of Jesus. Worshipping, to us, you know, if you worship a false god, well, of all the problems with that, you know, is. But we probably don't consider the false god a demon, a devil. The Jews did. Okay? The Jews said, and worship of any other being besides the one God is worship of a demon. And that's going to be consistent throughout all of St. Paul's writing in his letters, that pagans worship demons, and the Jews understood that to be the case. That's why you even see many of the false sacrifices of the pagan gods, so to speak, the pagan demons, why often even human sacrifice was. Who would you offer a human sacrifice to? Would you offer a human sacrifice not to a god, but to a demon? So it's a much, much stronger connection again that Jesus is alluding to in here, which is, so Psalm 96 is trying to bring out what the Jews would have understood, those listening to Jesus, about hearing that Caesar is divine. Jesus is doing, you see what a multiple, and that's why they went away amazed. They went away amazed because they were just astounded at all the ideas he was able to bring in to that one sentence. Whose image is on the coin and whose inscription is it? You know, it's brilliant, but then again, it's coming from Jesus. So, you know, it's not like it's it's not human wisdom. He's alluding to the fact about whose image, whose icon, which right away brings their mind back to Genesis and God created man in his image, right? It right away reminds them of the inscription, the false gods, which not only are not gods at all, but they are demonic persons. And so Jesus is saying, connect the dots for yourself. You know, you don't need to ask me this question.
Is it almost like Jesus is saying, okay, so the emperor claims that he's from divine origin. So
did he create the universe? You know,
right, so he's saying, so if the demon's picture is on here, give the demon
what
is
this?
That's his picture on the coin.
But
give it to him.
You are made in God's image. So you give to God what is God's due. In other words, you give God yourself. You give the demon his money. Okay, the demon wants his money, you give him his money because the money has his image on it. But you bear the image of God. So therefore, you owe yourself to God. Okay? And so he ties in all these ideas, which is why, I don't know why they were, you know, without going through this, you would never understand that last sentence when it says they went away amazed at his words. Because how could they respond to this? What else could they possibly say? Besides, you know, just to silence, going away in silence. There was, I found here, a St. Lawrence of Brindisi. You know, I see a couple of other thoughts I jotted down here. You know, so St. Paul will teach that the false gods are not just false gods, but they're actually demonic gods. But also in the New Testament, in Romans 13 and following, Paul admonishes the fact that, you know, we live under an authority and we are to respect that authority, with the ultimate authority being God. And in the first and second letters to Peter says you need to pray for Caesar. You need to pray for your human authorities because these human authorities are subject to a divine authority. So they do two things. I mean, you might want to think that, okay, well, if St. Paul is going to say that the false gods are that they worship are demons, just write them off, have nothing to do with them. He doesn't say that at all. He says, no, you pray for them. You know, you obey them because they are civil authorities who don't recognize that they too are under a divine authority. So they need to be prayed for, which is why to this very day we pray for the president, we pray for all the people in government, the local and national leaders and so forth, to recognize that their human authority to which we are subject to really comes from God, and they are subject to a divine authority. Okay? St. Lawrence of Brindisi, he lived early 17th century, he was a doctor of the church. He spoke about this very passage about Caesar. He said, to each, he says, must be given what belongs to him. This surely is a judgment fully of heavenly wisdom and instruction, for it teaches that authority is twofold, having an earthly and human aspect and a heavenly and divine aspect. It teaches that we owe a twofold duty of obedience to human laws and to the law of God. The coin bearing Caesar's likeness and inscription must be given to Caesar, and the one stamped with the divine image and likeness must be given to God. Who is the coin stamped with the divine image and likeness? Man and woman. Say that. So you give to Caesar what has Caesar's image stamped on it. You give to God what has God's image stamped on it. This is brilliant, I think, by St. Lawrence. Right? We bear the imprint of your glorious face, O Lord. We are made in the image and likeness of God. So you, O Christian, because you are a human being, are God's tribute money, a little coin bearing the image and likeness of the divine emperor. So once again, the human person has the duty to obey divine authority, human authority, where we'll talk about where it's lawful and so forth, but ultimately divine authority. You know, I'll tell you something just personally, and I don't, but it's been working for many years in my life. It says, as a Christian, I really should not break a speed limit, right? And although sometimes I do, immediately when I see that, this passage comes to mind, and I slow down. And I, you know, part of it because you don't want to get a ticket, right? But for the real reason, Jesus said, give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar. Right? You have a human authority that you live under. That human authority says the speed limit here is 45 miles an hour. If you don't like that, you have the wherewithal to go to a city council or whatever you need to do and say, I think that's a ridiculous speed limit, it ought to be changed. But until that happens, I think Christians are obligated to obey.
I think you slow down because Mrs. Zamuda says slow down.
You know, some of our roads, the way our cars are made today, with the way some of the roads are, it's just so easy to go to exceed the speed limit. But, I mean, there's a higher level of even that. There's a higher level of even that. I think as Christians, we are called to obey just laws. And speed limits have been decided by our community. The community said it is. You know, when we don't know what reasons the community chose that to be 45 miles an hour, is it because of driveways, or their children, or their schools, or their businesses, or their cars pulling in and out?
Are they looking for more income to be able to pick up speed?
Yeah, there's that other side of it too. Okay. Yeah. Today, I think actually we have the problem in the other direction, right? We have a government, a civil authority that's trying to get us to give it prominence over the divine. Governments are trying to force us to act in opposition to our consciences, right? Particularly in regard to things like abortion, contraception, euthanasia, capital punishment. The government is claiming ultimate authority over many of those issues. Look at right now, this 16-year-old girl came across the border from Mexico into Texas because she's pregnant and she wants to get an abortion. And a judge ruled that she has the right to get an abortion. Okay? No human court has that authority to do that, you see. But yet human courts are starting to usurp that very authority. The Affordable Care Act is saying to employers, you must provide birth control to your employees free of charge, even if it opposes your conscience. Even if your faith beliefs say, no, this is evil, I can't do this. If you have to do it, or we're going to use the power of the law to whatever, you know, fine you, put you in jail, close you down, do whatever. I think we have the other problem today. We don't have so much a problem of us worshiping false gods per se, or it's a disordering of what God intended in terms of human authority. Yes, there should be human authority. Religious freedom, right? We often see that there's becoming, it's getting to the point where there's no room to be a Christian anymore in this society, right? Governments are saying you can't do certain things. You can't pray Christian prayers in school. You can't make the sign of the cross if you're a football player in public. And people are fine, they say, because they find it offensive and so forth. They say, and they're coming up with laws saying that you can't do that. You know, student organizations on college campuses can't, you know, you could start a pro-abortion group, but you can't start a pro-life group because they say, no, it's you know, a hate group, or it's this, or it's that, or it's making people upset, or so it's actually going the other way. I think this whole right to life, none of these things belong to Caesar, right? They belong to God and only to God. So what do we render unto Caesar? The Catechism of the Catholic Church has some clear statements on this. The Catechism says, respect for the rule of law. We owe respect and obedience to legitimate authority acting for the common good. We do not, however, owe allegiance to unjust laws, racist laws, or those that deny the right to life, for example. The Catechism talks about the common good. We owe it to the government to cooperate in efforts to promote the common good, which means the promotion of human rights, spiritual and material benefits, peace and security. This is best achieved through subsidiarity. You know, the Catholic Church is big on subsidiarity, which means things happen at the lowest possible level. We as a community decide what's best for our community in terms of how we live here in High Springs or Alachua County or whatever the case may be. At the lowest possible level, we the people decide what's best for the common good for this society, in consistent with you know, as you move up the chain. And finally, the Catechism says taxes. As Jesus says, we owe taxes to the government. Washington is on our dollar bill, and we must render it to Washington, D.C. Okay? So this entire gospel is basically an understanding of what does it mean, render unto Caesar that which belongs to Caesar, and to God that which belongs to God. If we are stamped in the image and likeness of God, if we are the icon of God, as Genesis tells us, it means that when people see us, when people hear us, they want to see and hear Christ. We ought to be, and that's what was the gospel acclamation. Who has the missalet? The gospel acclamation. The gospel acclamation is always the clue. How is the first reading, from usually from the Old Testament, how is the first reading linked to the gospel? The gospel acclamation tells you that. And the gospel acclamation is... Got it? It's in the missalette.
No.
The gospel.
Here we go.
Here we go. Shine like lights in the world as you hold on to the word of life.
Okay, you see it? You see the link between the first reading and the gospel?
Yeah.
Shine like light. Whose image do you bear? That's the basic question. You know, I always like to leave, whenever I preach, certainly, I always like to leave with a question that people can take away and think about. And whose image do you bear? That's your reflection question for the day. Whose image do you bear? Who are you in the image and likeness of? Are you in the image and likeness of Caesar, the government? Or are you in the image and likeness of God?
So is he really referring to all humankind at that point?
Is who referring to?
Jesus. To all humankind.
Yes, all humankind is made.
So whether you are Jew or...
Sure, because that was... Genesis is before there was an Abraham,
right,
and the people of Israel.
Right.
Everybody.
It's everyone in the world.
After that came Ishmael mm-hmm. and all the whole descendancy. Mm-hmm. Every human being made in the image and likeness of God. Every race, every
Buddhist,
nationality.
Right. So
you know,
every, okay.
Black, white, yellow, red, green, blue, Buddhist, everybody. Everybody is made in... So there's an inherent dignity there that you don't earn, that you know, nobody gives you or God gives you. You know, and by the very fact that you are a human being, inherent in you is a fundamental dignity that no one can take away from you, or no one can deny you.
Yeah. It's called a birthright.
It's a birthright, that's right. It's a birthright. All human beings have a birthright there by fact that they're stamped with the image of God. So... How are we doing on time? 9:46. Do you have to?
I have to leave.
Now, We're going to start with this thing. We're going to start promptly at 9. No, because it's getting later and later every week, and we can't do that. I mean, you know, sometimes I'm like, oh, it's 9:30. We better start. Yeah, no, we're going to stop that.
Sister Tina today, which is unusual, she's giving a talk on depression and suicide.
So today. I was wondering if we may want to all attend that. As you know, since
what
this
time
is
does that start?
10 o'clock, and it's 10:15 now, and that's over in the hall, right?
It's in the hall.
It's in the
that's
hall.
That's just a one-time class.
Sister T. I thought initially it was going to be on the signs of suicide,
mm-hmm.
but it sounds now what you're saying.
She's saying at breakfast that it's going to be more on depression.
Depression,
okay.
Which
okay.
will of course bring in suicide.
Bring in the issue with suicide.
Mm-hmm. Or
sounds depressing.
Yeah. Or stay here, right?
Because a lot of people in this world are suffering from that. I mean, I would suggest we go here. I'd love to hear the talk. I would think we'd
sure,
all love
listen.
To. You know, we'll all go here.
Can I ask a question then before we go? It's got nothing to do with that. I went last night, and of course they're talking about Father leaving.
Yeah.
And they're talking about something about presenting stuff to him or gifts. I thought he's not supposed to... Are these personal gifts? I mean, what are these...
I didn't see the bulletin myself yet either, but
yeah.
You know, people want to give.
Usually spiritual gifts too.
That's what a lot of it is going to be, spiritual bouquet,
well,
so to
like
speak.
If you want to offer masses or communions for Father, pray
spend an hour before the Blessed Sacrament for him in the
shrine.
But
you're welcome to give him something.
But I mean, does this have to do with, like, because they say on the weekend of Saturday, November 4th and Sunday, November 5th, there will be a reception after each.
Right.
Regularly scheduled masses. So what does that mean? Like, it's like in the Life Center? You know?
Yeah.
Yes.
So what, does he go around to each table? Or
no, no. People want to give him things. That's all. People want to give him gifts. He doesn't want gifts, but people want to give him gifts.
So, and you don't have to.
You don't have to. A card, maybe saying
yeah.
to Father.
A card.
Or just going up to him and saying
how much you've
Father.
Meant to
yeah, that's
being
all.
Pastor for the past 10 years. That kind
yeah,
of thing.
But I only had him for not even a year. Yeah,
okay, for the past year.
Heard anything about the new priest?
We still don't know.
Oh. So we have to pray very hard.
I need to go over that.
All right. So I'll meet you. Well, I'm going to go over there too. I'll give you a ride. Hang on.